You're listening to Shift in Action, a program of wisdom media and spirited exchange offered through the Institute of Noetic Sciences. For more information, visit www.shiftinaction.com.
Good morning. How does one study consciousness? How does one research consciousness? Long time ago, when I was right at the beginning of my own journey in consciousness studies, I came across a book in which there are two very intelligently constructed cartoons. In the first frame, a student is looking at a professor with admiring eyes. The caption says, "Professor, how do you know so much?" And the professor says, "Because I open my eyes." In the next frame, a admiring student is similarly looking at a Zen master who is meditating and asks, "Zen master, how do you know so much?" And the Zen master says, "Because I close my eyes." Now, this is really the division, the two ways of looking that we all have. We all intuitively know that with open eyes, it's possible to study consciousness, but only to some extent. With closed eyes, we can study consciousness also. And perhaps, ultimately, closed eyes are the only way to get to the subtleties of consciousness. So, I'll try to do both today. I'll give you a glimpse of what the new science based on quantum physics is telling us. And I would make the point that if these two ways could be integrated, that I think is the best approach to consciousness. For me, it is very satisfying. Now, I'll present to you a science, which I call science within consciousness, which is based on quantum physics, which does this, which integrates the two ways of investigating consciousness, science, scientific way, and the spiritual way. It was wonderful to start this morning with spiritual music. I hope you are resonating with it sufficiently to take this talk not only as an intellectual journey, but also a journey towards the heart, because that's where the integration has to happen. So let's look at the first slide already. Let's get into the subject because time is short. You may have to turn the whole... No, it's okay. Good. Okay. Can you focus a little bit more? All right. Now, quantum physics, I know, causes great amount of anxiety in the non-scientists. But its message actually is probably very, very easy to grasp, provided you let your intuition help you. The three quantum gifts to this integration that is taking place between science and spirituality are really the essence of quantum physics. The first one is called discontinuity. Little unclear, agreed. Continuity we understand. Continuity is the idea that all movement that occurs has a causal explanation behind it. Something happened before that precipitated what is happening now. Now, physicists have made this assumption under the aegis of Newtonian physics for a long time. Quantum physics from the inception had a different idea, an additional idea of movement. Next one, please. You may have to come back to that one, so leave that one aside. Now, in our own way, we have known about discontinuous movement even before quantum physics was discovered. Here is Einstein discovering his famous law E equals mc squared. So he writes E equals ms squared on the top of the backboard and crosses it out. And then he writes E equals mb square and crosses it out. The caption says the creative moment. And it's funny, because we all know in our heart that creativity is not like this. What is creativity like? Next one, please. Well, here is Niels Bohr's model of the atom. Niels Bohr says, following his predecessors, yes, electrons go around the atomic nucleus in continuous motion, in orbit. This part of the movement of electron is certainly continuous, describable by Newtonian physics. But then the electrons do a funny thing when they jump from one orbit to another. There, said Niels Bohr, electrons never go through the intervening space. You heard me correctly. Electrons jump from one place to another without going through the intervening space. The motion is discontinuous. It's called a quantum leap, a phrase that is quite familiar to you today. So Niels Bohr knew something that quantum physics now confirms about the movement of the electron that we also know from our own experience exists in our creativity. Fundamentally, the electron's movement from one orbit to another, this discontinuous leap, is the same kind of leap that we take in creativity, where we jump from one thought to another, but without any connection between the two thoughts. Creativity is a discontinuous leap in thought. Let's go back to the first slide, please. I want to confirm that you remember the other two lessons. Non-locality is the second one. What is non-locality? Again, locality is easy to understand. Locality is the idea that everything that happens, every phenomena that take place, are caused by something in the locality, with the exchange of energy, with the exchange of signals. This is the idea. So, are there non-local things? These two, again, we can ask our simple experience. I'm sure Marilyn Schlitz told you about the beautiful research that she is doing and others are doing about phenomena that defies this local idea, locality idea. Defies because there is no signal that can be found, and yet influences are abound. So how can influences be without exchange of energy or exchange of local signals? Newtonian physics has no answer for it. And yet, quantum physics from its inception is telling us that this is so. Next one, please. Now here is the quantum picture of when two particles interact and become correlated. If two particles, quantum objects, interact, they become correlated in such a way that if particle A moves away from particle B, even galaxies apart, even then, whatever particle A does, object A does, particle B can reciprocate. So they have a subtle dance going on between them, which is inexplicable in terms of exchange of any signals or exchange of any energy. In quantum physics, we call this quantum non-locality. Now, can this be an explanation of human phenomena that Schlitz talks about? Yes, it can. There is some very definite experiment, an objective experiment that has been replicated, that was done about 5-6 years ago at the University of Mexico by Greenberg, which suggests conclusively that this is so. Next one, please. Now, in human terms, what would it be like to correlate two people? Greenberg had the brilliant idea that if two people meditate together with the intention that they will have direct communication without exchange of signals, then maybe they will have quantum correlation between them. And then originally the experiment was planned such that one person goes to one side of the earth, the other person goes to the other side of the earth. One person is given a stimulus. In this cartoon, the stimulus is a touch stimulus from a cactus. And if both people say, ouch, then we'll have a proof. Of course, that would not be very objective. So what Greenberg had was he connected the two people with EEG and electroencephalograms, and measured their brain waves. They had to do some computer analysis to get the noise out. But when you got the signals and compared the signals, then you get an astounding result. And incidentally, he did not finish the experiment to this extent. So the distance between the two observers were 46 feet or so in one experiment and about 14 feet in another experiment. Next slide, please. Now the top curve shows you the result of one observer seeing a whole bunch of light flashes. The signal chosen was light flashes because the occipital area is the easiest to study with these so-called evoked potential studies. So the first observer who is seeing the light signal clearly shows electrical activity that is summarized as evoked potential. If you could read the strengths, they're like 0.4 microvolts at the peaks. Now, the second subject, who is in a Faraday cage, electromagnetically isolated from the first, so there is no local signal between them, the second subject is not seeing any light flashes. The second subject doesn't even know when light flashes are going to be shown to the first subject. And yet, the second subject's brain displays electrical activity, as summarized by a transferred potential from the EEG machine. And the strength of the transferred potential is right on the ball, similar to the evoked potential in the first subject. Even the phases of the two potentials coincide to about 70%. This could not be coincidence, and they tested it. They took subjects who did not meditate together, controlled subjects, who could not hold the intention of being in direct communication. Next one, please. And these subjects did not show a transferred potential. The transferred potential in this case is 1/10 of the evoked potential in strength. I don't know if you can see the ordinate, but it's 0.04, 0.05, that kind of strength, instead of 0.4 or 0.3, that kind of strength. And the phase overlap also, likewise, is hardly any. So therefore, the conclusion is inescapable that quantum non-locality happens also between brains. And therefore, quantum non-locality between minds, that telepathy, experiments of the kind that Marilyn does, is completely believable. There are some subtle aspects to be figured out, to be sure. I'll talk about them later. But the experiment is wonderfully demonstrating that there is quantum non-locality. What is best is that last year, Peter Fenwick in England, a neuropsychiatrist in England, duplicated this experiment with auditory signals. Next one, please. Now, I'm not going to show you the first slide again, but I hope you remember the third item, because it is this third item which is the most interesting one and which is where consciousness directly makes its entrance. The third item is called downward causation. Downward causation. Now, that's an intriguing phrase. What does it mean? In the olden days, when there was a spiritual worldview all over the world, it meant that God intervenes in the world. And because God is conceived of transcendent and up there, naturally the God acting on the world was called downward causation. Now, we are reviving this phrase for a good reason. We are reviving this phrase because the way that the materialist thinkers among us, most of the scientists, the way they picture the world is one based on what is called upward causation. The idea that materialists have about the world is that everything is the play of elementary particles and their interactions. Elementary particles make atoms, make molecules, make cells, including neurons. Neurons make the brain, and everything else is brain phenomena, or I should say epi phenomena, secondary phenomena of the brain. So consciousness in this way of viewing is a physical phenomenon, a material phenomenon, emanating from the brain somehow. So in this way of thinking, everything is upward causation. Now what happens in quantum physics is something very astounding. Quantum physics says that upward causation does not give you movement of objects. Upward causation cannot predict movement of objects. Upward causation has nothing, no mechanism to give you for the trajectories that objects follow in space and time. So what do these upward causation and material interactions produce? What they produce, says quantum physics, and this part is completely mathematical and algorithmic, completely scientific. What these particle interactions do is to produce what is called waves of possibility. Now that's a little technical, but the idea is very, very simple. Upward causation only gives us possibility and probability. Can you grasp that? Let's give a little example. Imagine an electron released right here in this room. This electron is going to have some movement. Quantum physics says that it's going to spread all over the room as a wave, like the sound waves from my mouth is spreading. But strangely, what quantum physics says is also that the spreading is not actual spreading in actual space. The spreading only is in possible space and possible spreading. In possibility, very soon, within a matter of seconds, the electron will have the possibility and probabilities attached to each possibility of being everywhere in the room. But if you set up Geiger counters all over the room, you're not going to see the electron triggering every one of these Geiger counters. So electrons are not physically spread all over the room. Only in possibility. Only one of the Geiger counters is going to take in one particular experiment. But in another experiment, another Geiger counter will tick, and very soon you can make a curve of all the possibilities that the electrons had, and the probabilities calculated by quantum physics will turn out to be quite correct. So quantum physics has very good predictive power so long as you do experiments, a lot of them, so long as you talk about a lot of events. But the question arises, what happens in a single event? Which Geiger counter will tick in a single event? Can we predict this? And here quantum physics says a very stubborn thing. No, we cannot predict it. It's discontinuous. No, we cannot predict it. So who does it? What collapses the electron's wave of possibility into an actual event? What indeed? This is what the idea of downward causation. Downward causation, because remember in the materialist picture, consciousness is the topmost phenomenon, brain and then consciousness. So if consciousness can act on the brain, that would be consciousness acting downward on the brain. But it's more complicated than that. Because if consciousness is a brain phenomenon, then consciousness itself is, like all quantum objects, just a possibility wave. A wave of possibility cannot collapse other possibilities into actual events. This is the big measurement paradox, quantum measurement paradox. Even physicists like Richard Feynman used to say, nobody understands quantum physics. This is a very popular statement by many, many physicists. Nobody understands quantum physics, except people forget that there is a caveat to this. Nobody understands quantum physics if they hold on to the materialist belief system. Then nobody understands quantum physics. The question that opens up quantum physics is that suppose we change that belief system, then what? So this belief system started changing with John von Neumann way back when, but then paradoxes were raised, and that's what arrested the development. And then finally the paradoxes were solved in the last decade or so, and this is what I'm going to present to you today. So to summarize, this is a picture of... Is there any more focusing possible? Can you see all this? The writings you cannot see. Oh, that's okay. Yeah, that's better. Now, this is the summary of quantum movement. If you can remember this one picture, you have understood all there is to understand in quantum physics. And you will never entertain the thought that nobody understands quantum mechanics, because everyone can and you can. Quantum objects proliferate in possibility. They become superpositions of possibility. They become waves of possibility when we are not observing them, in between our observation. So these objects, chairs, tables, projectors, your body, these objects, even these macro objects, really are waves of possibility. Hard to imagine, isn't it? Because we are so used to looking at things as things. But Heisenberg said, a co-discoverer of quantum physics, atoms are not things. And similarly, chairs and tables, which are made up of atoms, are not things either. What are they? Well, they are waves of possibility in consciousness. Let's see how that idea plays. There are waves of possibility in consciousness, and when consciousness looks, when we do an experiment, then the waves of possibility collapse down to one unique actual event. Is it very hard to understand? It is actually. If you are too rushed, then I'll say, wait. It is actually hard to understand. Why? Because consciousness, as you have shown, could not be material in this way of thinking. If it is material, then again back to the paradox, because consciousness itself is possibility. How can possibility collapse possibility into actuality? So how does consciousness do it? If it's a separate entity, non-material entity, then how does a non-material entity interact with a material entity? How does it do it? How can a little pick of you on a Geiger counter all of a sudden materialize, Geiger counter, pointer and everything, and a tick is hard? Hard to understand. What is the magic of consciousness? How does it do it? Is it acting on the objects with energy? Then energy has to be conserved. But energy is already conserved. There is no energy coming in from outside. Now, these are the objections that physicists can raise. But let's look at this thoroughly. Next one, please. Now, here is a picture that many of you might have seen. There are two pictures within this one picture. One young woman and the other an old woman. Can you all see both? Wonderful. Now, the artist, by the way, called this picture my wife and my mother-in-law. Now, when we are seeing one picture or the other, what are we doing? Are we doing anything to the picture? No. The possibilities are already there in consciousness. We are just recognizing one of the possibilities by choosing the proper context of perception. That's all we are doing. So, collapse of possibility into actual event is a choice. Is a choice by recognition. Why? Because these possibilities are already within consciousness. The worldview of materialist science has to be turned upside down. In materialist science, everything is made up of elementary particles and their interactions. The view has to be changed to consciousness is basic, consciousness is the ground of being, and material objects exist within this consciousness as possibilities. Then everything is clear. Material objects exist in many, many multivariate, multifaceted possible states. Consciousness chooses one of these possible states, and that one becomes the actual event in that particular observation, that particular measurement. But there is still more subtlety in this. One subtlety that can be raised immediately, suppose there is an ambiguous event. Imagine yourself at a crossroad in Sacramento, and you are approaching the streetlight, and your friend is approaching a streetlight from the perpendicular road. You both, of course, want green light. Now suppose this light is a quantum traffic light. What does that mean? It has two possibilities. And the possibilities are not going to manifest until one of you choose. So the two possibilities are red and green. Now, being busy Californians, can you imagine not choosing green? So both of you will choose green. And then whose choice will count? Whose choice counts? This is a severe paradox. This is a severe paradox. For a long time, it's timed the impoverished thinking of many, all of us, really. And then three of us, Ludwig Voss in Australia, myself in Oregon, and Casey Blood in Rutgers, New Jersey, three of us rose to the occasion and found the solution. Solution is astoundingly mystical. Next one, please. Behind the diverse eyes, the individual eyes that think that they choose, there is the one eye of consciousness. There is only the universal consciousness. There is only the unity consciousness that really chooses. So here is the thing. You know, consciousness collapses possibility into actual events has practically become a popular notion today, thanks to Fred Alan Wolf, who wrote a book as early as 1970 to promulgate this idea. But there is something subtle about it. We create our reality, no doubt. The subtitle of my book, likewise, is How Consciousness Creates the Material World. But there is a subtlety that you all must comprehend. And here is that subtlety. We do not create reality. We do not create reality in the ordinary state of our consciousness that we call our ego. We do not create reality. It's not that simple. Not in our ego. But we do create reality when we are in a non-ordinary state of consciousness in which we are all one. This subtlety is very important. But this is also what mystics all around the world, the spiritual teachers, this is also what they are saying. This is where science and spirituality can meet. This is where the professor who says, I open my eyes and discover quantum mechanics and therefore discover the oneness of consciousness. And this is where the Zen master who closes his eyes and therefore discovers the oneness of consciousness. This is where they meet together. This is where quantum physics is finally confirming what the mystics have been saying. There is one more subtlety. Next one, please. This is also a summary of what I have told you so far. Consciousness and waves of possibility. This is reality. This is unbroken wholeness that David Bohm so much talked about. How does that unbroken wholeness become split into subject and object? In the quantum measurement. So quantum measurement has not only created objects, manifest objects in definite states, it also has created a subject that views this object as separate from itself. Somehow consciousness has identified with one of the objects that were collapsed, namely the brain. So there is a subject-object split. This has two astounding parts. One is that the subject-object split is coming right out of the event of collapse. So collapse has a special characteristic. It has a special characteristic that we must recognize as co-creation. Does the subject collapse the object? That would be incorrect to say. Because we can equally say that the object causes the subject. The subject-object split is co-created by the event of quantum measurement. This co-creation idea is already involved in some drawings that M.C. Escher did. Next one, please. Most famous of which is drawing hands. The left hand draws the right hand draws the left. But it is incorrect to say that each one is the head honcho in the drawing. They are co-creating each other. So the co-creation is a very important point of quantum measurement. I don't create you any more than you create me. Subjects don't create objects any more than objects create subjects. Objects are subjects are co-created in the event. So I create my reality has to be substituted by saying that I create my reality in a non-ordinary state of consciousness in which you and I are one, and then further subtlety has to be added that actually we co-create the world. We co-create the world. Go back to the last slide, please. There is one more aspect of this picture that I would like to confront you with, which is that what we co-create, all these objects, we co-create in our experience. In our experience. Quantum physics has been very stubborn about this conclusion. Nothing exists outside of our experience. Nothing exists outside. It is a mistake to think that this chair exists outside of my experience of seeing it a chair. So is true for tables, buildings, even the moon and the earth. All of this. Difficult to comprehend, but certainly measurable. In a recent experiment, people took a one-ton object and measured if it really is stationary, like it seems to be outside of our consciousness, or does it really move while we are not looking at it. So people didn't look at it for a while, and then measured the position again. And lo and behold, with laser beams, we can measure such imperceptible distances today, it moved 10 to the minus 17 centimeters. Can you imagine? 10 to the minus 17 centimeters. But it moves. It moves. So objects really do become just possible movements in between our observation. They do not occupy a place just because they seem. It seems that way. Go back to the next slide, please. The drawing hands. Another characteristic of the drawing hands that now I would like to emphasize is that, look, this is an illusion. This is an illusion. The right hand is not really drawing the left hand, nor is the left hand drawing the right hand. It is an illusion. Escher is drawing them both. So similarly, consciousness creates the material world. The subject-object split is illusory. This too is part of the mystical teaching over the ages. And we have to understand all this if you have to understand consciousness. We have to understand all this. Consciousness is not an object. Consciousness is that which enables us to enjoy the world in its subject-object split version. Consciousness is the prime mover in the sense of exerting downward causation in a discontinuous way. So to discover consciousness beyond this subject-object split, beyond this co-creation, beyond this appearance, is not going to be easy. But we can do it. I'll come back to this point towards the end of my talk, because I did say that I'll go into the mystical part of consciousness exploration. Next one, please. Now, time won't permit me, but I should say that downward causation is very much also an experimentally verified phenomenon. Helmut Schmidt did some experiments a few years back, which shows this quite conclusively. And a discontinuity, by the way, this quantum leap has also recently been observed directly, not in the human affairs. There you have to depend on subjective descriptions of creativity from people. But in objective domain, for electrons, it has been verified that the electrons really do take quantum leaps without going through intervening space. Now, let's talk about the ego for a moment. Because it is true that although quantum physics is suggesting that if we have a quantum description of ourselves, then moment to moment, we should have discontinuous collapses. But our ordinary experience is not discontinuous. It's a stream. It's a stream of consciousness that we experience. So how does this discontinuity become continuous once again in our experience? This has to be understood. The understanding of this also makes clear the connection between behaviorism, the deterministic way of looking at ourselves, and the transpersonal view of ourselves. The main point here is memory. Quantum measurement also creates memory in the brain. Now, what happens due to the memory? Next time we see a stimulus, which you have experienced before, not only we are seeing the original stimulus, we are also seeing the brain memory stimulus, which is played back. So this causes a feedback in the quantum movement. Now, what my student Mark Mitchell, and I did was to put in this feedback in a quantum equation and then study the effect of this feedback. When we solved this equation, we found an astounding thing. The solutions modified the probabilities attached to the possibilities. In what way? Every possibility is modified in terms of the probability. The probabilities of those possibilities which have been collapsed before are enhanced. In other words, the way you have experienced things before gets an upper hand in terms of probabilities. They become more and more probable in your later experiences. Isn't this what we call conditioning? So we become conditioned as a result of memory. And this is what produces a pattern of habit that we identify with. Now, this is what we call our ego. That plus the personal history that the memories carry. And this ego then becomes our individuality, becomes our persona, becomes our character. Next one, please. But behind the ego, we retain that freedom of choice. And I present you the main dictum then of the new science, and this has to be compared with the dictum of Descartes. Descartes thought that the way to define us is I think, therefore I am. The thinking mind, which forever since, you know, even now, today, controls us. How many of us, even consciousness researchers, put their thinking mind on top of everything else, and then we cannot study consciousness very well. We are stuck by the thinking mind. Quantum physics is telling us, giving us a way out. It's not the thinking mind that defines our being. Thinking mind defines the ego, habits of thinking. Our being is defined by opto, I choose. Opto, I choose. I choose, therefore I am. Opto ergo sum. This is the definition of ourselves. Next one, please.